Welcome to The Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and today I talked to two different leaders in two different sectors, two different states, who couldn't be any more different except for one thing that unites them, is that they're two people I admire very much and who I've had a chance to see up close doing incredible work for people. And the reason why I'm highlighting these two folks is because I think so much of the news is negative. Like, who stumbled? SBF, Elizabeth Holmes, what stupid thing did Elon Musk say today? What divides us, right? And we don't spend enough time talking about people who put their heads down and do great work to make people's lives better. And that should give us some reason for idealism, to know that there are people out there who are doing the work. And often those people who are doing the work, because they're doing the work, have a lot more interesting things to say than the people who commentate on that work. So the two different people we're talking to is my friend Marshall, who runs this company down in Mississippi that I got a chance to see up close, that's providing incredible results for some of the hardest to reach patients in the country. And Marshall is just a wonderful, wonderful person and has a unique insight into how to just do medical care right and ethically. And then we're going to talk to my friend Zach, who's the head of emergency management in New York City. And he'll talk about, you know, what is it mean to obsess over on a daily basis? What could go wrong for a city of gazillion people with a lot of different threats and a lot of different, you know, threats, both people-driven and natural? And how do you balance those threats? How do you prepare for them? How do you react to them? How do you collaborate? How do you hold people accountable? And then we'll talk about the migrant issue as well, which he's been at the center of. So those are two people that we're going to talk to today. But before we get to them, if you haven't yet, go online, wherever you listen to this, Apple, Spotify, wherever, and leave a review, 5-star review, and write something about what you love about this podcast, because that really helps us. You know, right at the moment, we don't really bother you with ads or anything like that. This is the one thing you could do to show your appreciation for our team. Because, you know, in a world where we're a nonprofit, like, we don't get all the same kind of feedback that a for-profit company gets. So those reviews really matter to us. If you haven't yet either and you have something to say, leave us a voicemail, 321-200-0570. We will be doing a roll-up episode of a bunch of voicemails soon. If there's a segment you want us to do, a question you have, et cetera, that is the place to do it. Well, with that, let's get to this episode. All right. Well, today I'm welcoming on my friend Marshall Bolden, Dr. Marshall Bolden. He is the Chief Medical Officer, Vice Chairman, and Co-Founder of Vigilant Health, which we'll talk all about in this interview. He was previously an Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, where he was Director of the University of Mississippi Diabetes and Metabolism Center. He's done a whole bunch of different things. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He went to Hopkins for medical school. He is a proud son of the great state of Mississippi, and he's been fighting the good fight out there. Marshall, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Robbie. Good to see you, man.
Well, I saw you, I don't know, it might have been a year and a half ago, I went down to Mississippi and spent a day with you and your team. And I've actually talked about it a few times on this podcast, because what I saw was truly remarkable. You've been running this company called Vigilant Health, and I haven't seen quite many things about it. So maybe we'll just start there. Tell the audience a little bit about just some of the work that y'all are doing and really the problem you're trying to solve with Vigilant Health.
Well, thanks, Ravi. Yeah, I'll try to be as eloquent as possible. So Vigilant Health is really an idea that's been going a long time. Basically, I guess if you put us in a nutshell, we're there to fix the problems of modern medicine and why patients can't get the care they need and why they can't change their behaviors. But the story is, of course, much deeper. It goes back about 25 years. And I do think that's relevant to what we do. Our clients are self-insured plans, our insurance companies, Medicaid. Here in Mississippi and other states, we're in about 4 states, we are a new piece of care for the system. I'm trying to think of a word for us. I think integrationist is probably maybe one of the better ones. I'm looking for that word. If you come up with one, let me know.
Yeah, well, to explain a little bit to the audience about what you're saying is, it's not accidental that you talk about self-insurance and then Medicaid, for example, because those are two instances in which the insurance provider has a financial, a different kind of financial incentive, right, to keep costs down in a certain way. So maybe let's start there, because, like, obviously, one of the things we've talked about on this podcast is that the incentives don't always line up in the system, right? Like who's providing the insurance and who's paying for the insurance and who's getting paid are often very different people. Some observers are saying that's part of the reason why both costs go up in healthcare while quality of care doesn't necessarily improve.
Amen to that. We serve the clients, right? You know, and so the reason that we pick those clients or why those have been our clients for a long time is because it's the shortest pathway to recognition of value and to response because they're directly on the line for what they're paying for. Now, the wonderful thing about this 25-year experiment is that the answer is overwhelming. We're extremely data endowed company and have been for decades. The answer is overwhelming that the best medicine is absolutely the highest value care that you can get. And that was not a something I knew when I started. And it's often debated. It's generally not something that I think that's accepted by the standard, you know, the world out there of medicine as it's practiced, because they always go for something much shorter pathway to much more immediate reward that's not necessarily benefiting the patient. In fact, almost by definition, isn't benefiting the patient.
And so what you mean by the best care is the highest value, what you're saying is practicing a sort of deeper level of medicine to create strong short and long-term outcomes actually is good economics too.
Yes, it's very powerful economics. And we've got two decades of experience of measuring that in detail. So I can talk about why that works that way.
Let's set up what the sort of standard is, right? So the standard is, you know, like my dad ran a clinic that was associated with, that was sold to HCA eventually. You know, you go to standard big hospital, corporation, clinical practice or whatever, and the incentive is to get you through the door as quickly as possible with either a prescription in hand or some kind of like very quick, like directive. And often what they're trying to do is align the time of the doctor with whatever is billable to the insurance company. And they want that interaction to be as quick as possible, because if it lasts an hour, they may still only have that one billable action at the end. And so for their economics, they're saying, well, let's get six patients in 1 hour as opposed to one patient in 1 hour. But you spend, like you and your team, we'll spend a lot more than that 10 minutes with that patient, especially in the beginning.
Absolutely, yeah. So the latest figures, and they do change. You know, it's about 7 minutes or 6 minutes of conversation is what it boils down to for the average follow-up visit for a provider and the average, you know, billed encounter rate. And it's absolutely driven by volume like that. All fee-for-service medicine, and it's produced terrible perversion of incentives across American medical system over the last, you know, as long as it's been in place, but especially so since the mid-30 party insurers. So we just redefine the whole thing. We take our, we're a provider organization, but from the very beginning, we've been data blessed by facility with data and writing our own software, collecting one of our standards that we won't do business with anyone unless they can share claims information with us, and not just the claims that we're responsible for submitting or what our business is, but everyone with a whole picture on the patient, all claims, medical, pharmacy, and then putting that into the context for the plan. And so we've been doing that for a very long time. And when you do that, I mean, we've been doing value-based medicine since before that word was invented, right? You know, I mean, I it's like, oh, wow, they're doing this now. So that's great. So we've had a long time to define our value. And so when we come into a relationship, it's really open book, which is totally different than medicine in general. Everything's clear and above board and absolutely crystal clear. We can define our value for what we do, which is absolutely necessary. We always say we don't really care who we work with, and we don't. Our outcomes, I'd love to speak about that a bit about social determinants of health and that so forth in just a second. But what we say on a business conditions, we just need... if we can control the clinical setting, we've got a clinical model that's unique that drives behavior change, right? And it's and you have, we've got a information model that's unique that I alluded to a bit here, but I mean, it's an environment we work in to structure the humans, the patients, as well as the providers to deliver what they need to deliver. And then finally, the payment system. And if we can come to that and redefine what we get paid, we can work with anybody. We don't care who that is. As long as we get that, we can reformat things. Once you reformat, And the short really short form answer is, if you restructure things that way, according to the way that humans are supposed to work, as primates are supposed to work, and the things that they respond to, you can get mass human behavior change reliably, like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah. And so this was something you said to me early when I visited you, which is, I think you said, we're in the sort of behavior change business more than anything else. We start there. And so I'll describe for the audience what I saw, so that, because they might be having a hard time imagining, well, what does this look like? So I think it was a life insurance company, is that right? That was based in Jackson. So we went to this life insurance company's headquarters. And basically what happens is the life insurance company, works with Vigilant. And basically your goal is to ensure that the people of this company are as healthy as possible. And in them being as healthy as possible, their entire care costs less. Obviously, the company wants them to be healthy because they want them to be healthy, but also the care costs less. And because they're self-insured, they have a vested financial interest in keeping those costs down as much as possible. And just as an aside for our audience, that is different than when I forget who we use for our health insurance, Aetna or something. Like, I pay Aetna for our employees, and I want them to be healthy as much as possible, but I pay a fee. So if our employees are healthy or not, it's the same fee every year. We're just a drop in the bucket to them. So as a company, we don't have an incentive other than just benevolence to keep our people as healthy as possible. And Aetna probably doesn't have much of an incentive long-term, because our employees will probably be on a different insurance company in 5 years, right? So there's just no incentive to keep the long-term costs down. Now, back to this life insurance company. So they hire you, and among other things that you do is that you establish clinics inside of the corporate facility. So there's a clinic inside, a medical clinic, in the headquarters of this life insurance company, and the vast, vast majority, I think it was like 80, 90% of the employees will take advantage of this on-site clinic, and basically they get health coaching and medical coaching, and this is on top of the primary care provider. And what you do is you assess them. You have these long intake meetings. I think they're like an hour with either a nurse practitioner or a doctor, where you basically get to know somebody, build a relationship with that person, and then understand what their sort of medical needs are and who they are as a person, what motivates them, what they're trying to do. But you also get them to share as much as possible to help you make good medical decisions. You then organize that information and assess their risk and coach them over time. And we had this really long, interesting meeting where your IT team was walking through this sort of database where you're like, this person has this risk of metabolic disorder, this person's pre-diabetic, these are the interventions we're trying, et cetera. And you're sitting there in the same building that these employees work in, and you flag anybody who, because you could see when they've gone in and gotten some other test, you flag somebody, say, oh, you know, Sally is now a code red. We need to get her in here in the next week because she is, you know, not pre-diabetic anymore. She's fully diabetic, and we need to, you know, aggressively intervene here to get her back to green. Is that a fair summary of what's going on here?
That is absolutely a fair summary. There's a whole industry that's more or less committed to that. I mean, you know, like on-site employer wellness clinics, there's sort of, but they appear that way on the outside. They say they do those things. What they really do, almost all of them, is to provide a cheap nurse practitioner level visit in a very low cost system that offsets a primary care visit with a primary care provider somewhere, removes them from the medical system, and guarantees a cheap visit to the provider. That's the whole industry sort of point of view. They dress it up various ways, but they don't really do anything different than that. Our setup is, yes, we take care of a whole plan like that. Ours is a completely different model of behavior change with the individual. We're there for their owls and their bumps and their bruises and their headaches when they come in. But we also know everything, literally everything else about them when they walk through the door. And we use that as an opportunity to make sure they're doing what they need to be doing in the system. Either we take care of it, we make sure their primary care doctor takes care of it, or whoever their subspecialists are. So this level of, it's a care management level. It's done by providers, not by care managers, but by actual providers. And our main function, Vigilant's so natural. It's like judo. It's like the way people work. So it just arises, right? That's because you're following all the natural tissue planes. But when you try to explain it, it gets a little complicated because people are complicated. Yet it's very easy to do and replicate. You're setting up an environment that people want to come to and want to be part of. It's a little M, little H medical home. They come because they trust you. That's the bottom line. They come because they trust. They don't trust the system. It's confusing. It's not set up for them. Any human entering the system can tell within 15 minutes of being in the system, this is not about me, right? And so what our product is, as I've always said, our real product, yes, we have tremendous healthcare outcomes and tremendous savings. Real product is producing, taking self-defeated people and turning them to self-managing, empowered individuals, which you can do at scale, and you can do that in any human population. Our outcomes are similar in Medicaid to white-collar insurance workers. So,
yeah, talk a little bit about the outcomes a little bit, if you have any of those at your fingertips, just for our audience's sake.
So really quick, a whole picture on this is I used to be a small town provider in the Mississippi Delta, which is one of the worst parts of this country, kind of the Haiti of North America. And I was in a small town practice. Small town practices were failing in the 90s. It was the last of internal medicine sort of kick really out there.
Well, in a separate conversation, I need to know like how a Rhodes Scholar from Johns Hopkins winds up in the Mississippi Delta. I mean, that must have been a calling.
Right. So that failed. I went to the University of Mississippi about 2000, and they, a little bit before that, and they said, boy, from private practice, you know how to see a lot of patients. You can turn that crank. We got a whole lot of unreimbursed diabetes care. We need you to go figure out how to take care of it. We're going to give you a half a day of your time and a half a day of a nurse practitioner's time. And you got a bunch of unwanted pharmacists, and we got about 25,000 unreimbursed visits a year. And that day, UMC was still a charity care hospital. That still existed in Mississippi in 1999. So anyway, we did that. I didn't know that I was actually not supposed to succeed at a university level. I was like supposed to keep getting the grant money, man, you know, and keep going. But we actually turned a system that actually worked, and it worked incredibly well. 40% of our patients were no pay, right? Couldn't even organize Medicaid. And I was invited to ADA every year to speak with all these big guys about all these amazing changes, these really poor people in the Mississippi Delta and how they extended over time. We did it for about 10 years. About a quarter of the state. It was really amazing. And we had equality of outcomes in 22 metabolic variables permanently, you know? I mean, and so from that, we created a business, and that's what Vigilant Health is. We started in diabetes. We realized it's way bigger than diabetes. It's just human behaviorism applied or medicine redesigned, the system broken, put back together. And that's what we do. We do much more than metabolic disease now, but the bottom line for most people here, and I'm just going to the chase on where the problem is, in America and in the Western world, it's the lifestyles we live. The lifestyle is just so different than it was 150, 200 years ago, which is what we evolved for. We don't have any of the machinery to take care of that. Short form is, of all the clients we treat, 90 cents on the dollar that everybody spends is spent in somebody who either has diabetes, hypertension, or dyslipidemia, you know, the cholesterol profile that's unhealthy and gives you heart attacks and so forth. Those are all weight-dependent problems, basically, type 2 diabetes. They're all weight-dependent problems. They're all inactivity. It's all lifestyle-related. None of those existed, almost did not exist 150 years ago in the United States at all, period. And so it's entirely lifestyle-related disease. And that's what we're a powerhouse at fixing. We fix that stuff. We change behavior. We support the primary care mission. We make the primary care guy successful because we've got all this information. We make him successful in his job, which he's overwhelmed and underperforming. Mississippi is the worst state, lowest per capita providers at all of any state with the worst healthcare performance, 50th in every healthcare parameter, you know. And so we put the primary care guy back on his horse and he can survive in a small town again and make money. Whereas we're in the background creating new pie because we're saving all this money from people doing the things he can't do, backing up to change this behavior. And the bottom line, really short on the economic argument about what my earlier point about why this was the best medicine, our focus really is, I mean, this is our real super specialty, is this metabolic change and the ability to change behavior about how people change their lives en masse. All of our clients, no client, you know, I thought when I went into this, we were saving money for a client. Well, that's a short pathway. You know, 3 years, you've probably saved everything you're going to save. First year, save a lot. Next year's less. Next year's like, okay, what are we going to do next? Which is the general theme you hear everywhere. You know, ACOs, everybody's got that problem. We don't. We're in our ninth year with our oldest clients for Vigilant, and they're still saving more money than when we met them, unadjusted for inflation. So every year, they save more and more and more money. One of the municipalities we serve has half the healthcare costs they did before we came. into being, right? You know, so they've half the cost of their plan. This life insurance is about a third of the cost of their plan. And it keeps, and the reason it keeps getting less and less is because there's the metabolic disease, or this lifestyle has changed, and the end results of that aren't happening. So dialysis is 40% less, strokes are 60% less, heart disease is 40% less. That's the long-term story. It's a really complicated tale. As you know, it's way too big for this amount of time. But it goes from, you said it earlier, I mean, no insurance company's got anybody for that long, right? And so these people do that we're falling for these long contracts. But that's the real answer. You get them immediately, you can save money. Short-term, we save money in the very first year from better consumerism. We just navigate, reduce the confusion and redundancy of medicine. You save a lot of money. And then it funds the whole thing. And you can just keep going year to year to year to year. We hadn't found a bottom yet.
Yeah, and you said something interesting earlier that I don't want people to miss, which is you are not only having success with these self-insured companies, but you're having success with Medicaid patients in Mississippi, which are among the highest risk, most difficult to reach, most difficult to treat, most unhealthy people in the entire country. And I think that's what has turned heads. I think, you know, our audience is very familiar with the sort of elite medical practice conversation that sort of dominates the sort of media sphere now. You know, you and I were exchanged this book on Peter Attia, where he's like charging hundreds of thousands of dollars per client to do all the fancy stuff. But tucked within that is this acknowledgement that you two share, which is behavior changes everything. And a certain series of, like, a very simple set of behavior changes that are actually hard to move, that take time and relationships and care, right? Like, how do you change what people eat? How do you change how they move about the world? How they even see themselves, right? And like, he's got all the money and time in the world to have those conversations with people who are motivated to begin with who walk through his doors. What you have is a group of people who are among the most downtrodden in this country, who not only sometimes don't walk through your doors, you have to go find them. You have to recruit them. So I think maybe as we kind of round this out, I think part of your secret sauce is this intake meeting, right? Which is the first meeting you really have with a patient. Talk a little bit about what you do in that first meeting.
Well, we treat everybody, of course, but the ones we're really after are the people who are problems, right? And have problems in their life. And just this is just the knowledge of the natural history of health plans and groups of people. I can find, say, you know, a 1300 life plan. 130 people are going to determine the future of that plan. They're not the ones who are expensive today, but the ones that are going to be expensive within the next 5 years. Those are exactly the ones I've been talking about whom you can actually change their trajectory. So we jump in this. So you can seize that group. That's the group you're really looking for to make an impact on the plan, but you've got to impact everybody. So we address everybody, right? So going to your question about what do we have in that first visit? So the average person that we're seeing for most of our clients is a very defeated individual. And anybody can think of your own interactions with your healthcare system, your child or your parents or you, if you've got problems, and all the frustrations that come with that, and how obviously it's not set up to benefit you or for your best interest. It's built to make money and keep a machine going, really, to be as frank as possible. So at any rate, one of the classic things that I notice, and I always have if I walk into the room to see a patient, is they won't meet gaze, G-A-Z-E. They won't meet gaze. That's a term of art in medicine about the state of a person. You say it when you meet them in an old, you know, internal medicine history. It's one of the first things you say. Patient will not meet gaze. And it means there is such a volume of human history in that. And almost 90-something percent of our patients won't looking you in the face. They have chronic problems. They have problems that are in life with everything, right? And it starts, it's their lifestyle. Lifestyle and health are part of it. They have other problems, but they've been told for their diabetes, hypertension, whatever, their overweightness, their unhealth by the guy who's only had 7 minutes with them because that's all they've got. I used to be that guy, you know? So I know the pressures, and the pressures are, I've only got 7 minutes. I've got 12 disease states to cover, and I've got to do something meaningful for them, and they won't be back, and I've got to cover everything. And so I just bam, 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 bam. And what else can you say? But this is lifestyle. It's your fault. You have gained too much. That's what they hear. You've gained too much weight. If you hadn't done this, you wouldn't be in this boat, you know, and now you're going to have this. And you threaten them. You've got all these risks and chances of dying, and you need to fix all this. And if you don't, you're going to die. And of course, they won't look at you. right? That's what everybody's told them. They have no time. That's the story that they've heard all their life. And the story is not that for metabolic disease. If you take hold of it, you take control of it, you can reverse so much of those lesions. You can't reverse end organ lesions, of course, but you can prevent the whole process, stop the horse at any point in the stream. It's very effective to do that. And we just turn them into winners. And it's just take the time with them and say, look, this is the way it really works. This is how insulin resistance works. This is how it works with energy storage. If you'll undo this and go backwards, your type 2 diabetes will go down on your medicines. You have to be eating what God intended you to eat. But you're going to like that once you get that to be a habit and you work with us. You make them winners. We make them winners in that first meeting, Ravi. They've got to meet, leave that meeting. That's one of the things we always, they got to meet, leave that meeting looking in our eyes, right? And when they leave that meeting, look in our eyes, they'll do something for us for a week or 2 weeks, even a rock, even somebody that can't even organize getting on Medicaid. If you can give them some hope that's reasonable, that's founded in logic, it's founded in trust, and get them back in a week or get them back in 2 weeks and you spent time with them and they know you're in it for their own best interest, they'll respond. I'm here to tell you, 90-something percent of human beings will respond to that at the level that they can respond. And you just take that and you play it for the next success. And all our software and all our system and all this stuff we've developed over all this time is just about that. It's playing for that next success, encouraging them, showing them they can be winners and supporting that behavior change. And the answer is, if you do that to humans, 90-something percent of them are going to respond to that. Literally, those are the kind of responses we get, are going to respond to that and are going to succeed and become winners.
Yeah, and it makes you think, you know, this the common conversation is how AI is going to impact medicine. But a lot of what you described, like obviously the back end, there's all sorts of work about how do you organize the information and all that, which will undoubtedly be impacted by AI. But that patient practitioner interaction, that relationship cannot be replaced by a computer. You know, like we're talking about the kind of people you're talking about, they need a human being that believes in them, that they look forward to seeing, that they want to open up to and talk about their health with. And so, you know, Marshall, thank you so much for joining us. When I visited you guys down in Mississippi, I came back and I told a friend, I was like, I don't know if I've ever met a more committed group of people who believe in what they're doing and who are so passionate, and what they're doing is special. And like, I just really true. You guys aren't just, you know, doctors and nurses and IT specialists. You're like a movement down there. You're almost like a preacher, you might even be a preacher. Everybody I know in Mississippi is a preacher on the side anyway, but I'm so inspired by what y'all are doing. For the audience, go out there and check out Vigilant Health. If I were Elon Musk, I would give you guys a gazillion dollars to scale and start your own insurance company and do, you know, integrated healthcare at scale. So hopefully if Elon's listening, he'll take note. But Marshall, thank you so much. I'm a big fan of everything y'all do.
Thanks, Robbie. We appreciate it. We're fans of yours too.
Well, I'm excited to welcome onto the podcast my good friend, Zach Iskel, who is the Commissioner for Emergency Management for New York City. This is the man when there's a heat wave, a blackout, hurricane, smoke storms, which we had recently, snowstorms, floods, search and rescue. We had an earthquake last week. I thought of you, Zach. Zach is the person whose job it is to manage said emergencies. And we're going to talk about what that means. And in some cases, try to avoid emergencies that are avoidable. Zach has such an interesting history. We've known each other, I don't know, for so long now. We're getting old. But he was a Marine. I met him shortly after he had returned from Iraq. He served two tours there and other assignments throughout Africa and the Middle East. And during his second tour of Iraq, he led a combined unit of U.S. Marines and Iraqi soldiers in some of the heaviest fighting during the Second Battle of Fallujah. If you remember, that was one of the nastiest battles of that war. He was awarded a Bronze Star for valor, and then he came back and served his community. He, you know, has been involved in civic life across the U.S. and in New York City in so many different ways, including with the Headstrong Project, which now cares for over 1,000 veterans a week in 30-plus cities. You know, Zach, you are the perfect person to talk about where we are as a city right now, especially when it comes to the migrant crisis, because I think, you know, you and Jason Kander and Ken Harbaugh and all these guys I know from the veteran community have been spending a lot of time on homeless issues for so long. So you actually have a really strong awareness and skill set for what it means to be displaced, no matter who you are. But before we get there, because that's where things, you know, I think are a little hot, Before we get there, I want to just hear about, like, I'm so curious what the day in the life of the New York City Commissioner of Emergency Management is like. So first of all, was that list accurate? Am I overstating the kinds of things that you're dealing with?
No, we do it all. We do it all. And so the agency was started in, I think, 1996 by Giuliani. And at the time, he really started, he had a lot of frustrations. He'd wake up in the morning, turn on the news, find out about a water main break, a subway stop or something that was happening around the city that nobody had known about, nobody woke him up about. And then he'd arrive on the scene and nobody would be in charge. And so he started an office in the mayor's office that was really responsible for 24-hour surveillance of the city, not sort of surveillance of people, but really of, are the trains running on time? Is the infrastructure working? Are there major issues that have big impacts that need to be addressed? And then those folks could go out and actually then manage the agencies that were working to address those problems. And over time, the agency has evolved as we have dealt with new events, whether it was 9/11, the 2003 blackout, Hurricane Sandy, COVID. You know, at each sort of these stages, the city evolved where now we don't just respond and monitor, but we also are there doing a ton of work in communities to help prepare New Yorkers beforehand so they have the information they need and the resources they need. We do a lot of work on the back end to help people recover from emergencies, whether it's folks displaced from a fire, helping them find a place to live for a few days before they move on with their lives or go into the shelter system, unfortunately. We do a lot of climate resiliency work with some of our partners at DEP and the Mayor's Office for Climate Equity, Climate and Environmental Justice. You know, those are sort of like big projects of how do we prevent, you know, coastal flooding in certain areas? What can we do to protect areas in and around Jamaica Bay? So the mission has expanded pretty drastically, and really it's also sort of what is needed. You know, when you emergency management is sort of a newer industry, so to speak, but it's also one that when you look around the country, emergency managers are involved in the migrant crisis. They're involved in the opioid crisis. They're getting involved in the homelessness crisis. I think anywhere that there's a real need for somebody who can manage an interagency process, emergency managers across the country are getting brought into that work.
You know, I like to think about it as like, you know, what your days are like, you know? So maybe give us an example. What is the single strangest day you've had since you've started this job?
Oh, God. There's so many of them. I mean, the smoke, the air pollution from Canada was a strange day.
I was thinking about you that day because I think people were coming at you, if I remember correctly, about it. I can't remember what they wanted you to do exactly, but yeah. It was a thing that as a New Yorker, like the earthquake, there are certain things I'm like, oh yeah, okay. Hurricanes, flooding, you know, like the bad flooding we had back in October. Those are things that we're kind of used to. Blackouts. Everybody's got their blackout stories in New York, snowstorms. Smokestorm was the first one I'd seen. Like, was that the kind of thing, like, do you guys have like a smokestorm? Did you have like a smokestorm plan? Like, is it?
So the way I was actually out of town. I went to the D-Day anniversary, 79th D-Day anniversary in Normandy with my son. I took my son over there. My grandfather landed at Normandy. There's not a lot of opportunities for my son to meet veterans on the beaches. I had some friends that were going to be jumping in to Normandy. And so I organized this trip with my son. And so we actually landed that day. And, you know, it was clear we had some challenges in front of us when we landed that evening. But I think it's also, you know, we responded at the agency to two different types of events. We have what we call, you know, there's a number of different types of events, but we have novel events, which are ones that are new, right? And you know, the air quality or the AQI emergency last summer is one of them. But really, we divide emergencies into two buckets, notice events and no notice events. So a notice event is we're monitoring the forecast, there's going to be some weather coming in, and you have some time to prepare. And then there's no notice events, which are ones that happen and you have to immediately respond. The earthquake on Friday is an example of a no notice one. You could have a steam pipe rupture, a fire, you know, things that, and some of them are not novel, right? We deal with fires, steam pipe explosions all the time. Some of them are novel. Like the last time we had an earthquake was 10 years ago, very different type of tools in our toolkit here at the agency. air quality, certainly a novel emergency. And, you know, generally there's sort of a checklist of things that you go through. In each of those cases, we really rely on our federal and state partners who have more of the, like, for example, with the earthquake, we really rely on USGS Geological Survey to confirm that this was seismic activity, to confirm it was an earthquake. We rely on them on guidance of what we push out. In the case of air quality, we really rely heavily on the State Department of Environmental Conservation. They do the air quality forecasting. Very, very hard to do. It's very complicated. It's very imprecise and inaccurate. Generally, you only have about 12 hours of leeway before you know you might be in sort of an orange or red category of AQI. But for those types of events, we really lean heavily on those state and federal partners for the to sort of give us a sense of what we are contending with and to confirm, you know, for example, on Friday, that it's an earthquake, right? There's a lot of things that can cause buildings to shake. We really try not to get ahead of those federal partners because you can get yourself into trouble, right? Maybe it was a big explosion in Bayonne, New Jersey. Maybe it was, you know, God forbid, a major building collapse. And so really, it's about making sure that we're getting the right information out to the public, and we rely on those partners to do it.
Yeah, you must have to be the ultimate diplomat because you have to rely, like, you know, you think about the NYPD, the FDNY, the Department of Sanitation, the DOT, the MTA, the federal government. I mean, you must have to just maintain strong relationships with those people. But at the same time, like when these emergencies happen, like, you know, you said, you talked about the genesis of the department. You have to kind of step in sometimes and coordinate, which means sometimes I can imagine you have to deliver inconvenient news or push people who are being slow and all that. Like, how do you balance those two?
It's hard. I will say, I mean, public servants generally, there is something amazing. One, it's a very small world, right? When you go out to any of these sort of events, it's generally the same folks that are working these events, at least at sort of a more of an operational level. Maybe the folks that work in the borough or that neighborhood are different, but the folks that are, you know, the fire chiefs or the borough commanders from the NYPD or the sanitation folks, those tend to be a lot of the same folks each time. And so you really have, you build those relationships. And I think, you know, the city developed something called SIMS, which is the City Incident Management System that really delineates who is in charge and what the roles are for almost every type of emergency. And so, you know, when you go out to a fire, for example, the FDNY chief on the scene is the incident commander, right? He's in charge. He's dealing with the most dangerous part of the problem, which is fighting the fire. But at the same time, there's all these impacts around that fire that need to be managed. And that's where we sort of come in and sort of take that off of his plate so that he or she can focus on fighting the fire. We can focus on, okay, there's displaced residents, there's street closures, there's traffic that needs to be put, you know, redirected, there's utilities that need to be shut off, there's information that needs to get out to the public. We can deal with all of that so they can focus on the most immediate, pressing, dangerous problem that they also have the core experience in, right? If it's a, you know, major gas leak, you know, it would be DEP. If it's a, you know, some sort of major life safety issue, like the Frank James shooting in the subway system, you have PD because they have the core expertise of dealing with a mass shooting. You also then have to contend with, like, there's also the life safety issue of EMS coming onto the scenes and navigating that. So the city does have a system that is designed to be able to manage that interagency process. But it's sometimes like, yeah, there's times where you have personalities that get in a room and they don't always get along. But I think our team here does a really, really good job of getting people to put sort of ego aside and really let's just sort of focus on the problem at hand, who are the best folks to solve for it, and how we can just move forward and making sure we're doing the best we can for New Yorkers.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, the proximate reason why I wanted to talk to you is because we have been looking deeply into this migrant issue in New York, and my hometown of Staten Island has had a vigorous debate around the future of migrants there. I thought to myself, you know, what is the emergency management role when it comes to an influx of migrants? Is that classified as an emergency for the city?
It was. I think we're trying to move now to a place that's more steady state. And so over the last, I mean, it's now been almost 2 years that we've been contending with this, our role has really evolved. So I think it started, we had these buses arriving at the Port Authority. people needed water. Roger that. We'll get water there to make sure. Because I mean, there was folks getting off these buses who had not were dehydrated, hungry. Some of them needed very real medical care. And so we sort of came in, provide the operational and logistics support, you know, to make sure, okay, we need an ambulance on scene with some EMS folks in case there's a pregnant woman that needs help or a sick kid. And we've had those situations. Somebody needs medication. Somebody needs to go to the hospital, have some translation services, have water, some food, just to sort of welcome folks in. Over time, that evolved where as we started to run out of space in our shelter system to helping build some of the large-scale HERCs and operate them alongside our partners at health and hospitals.
Oh, so you've been doing that. You've been part of that construction process?
We sort of manage at those sites a lot of the infrastructure. Health and hospitals provides the services. You know, the vast majority of this is still carried by Department of Social Services. But health and hospitals does a lot. We brought in other agencies that have a core expertise with housing, like HPD. You know, and then there's been other things that we've done. You know, one of the things that we try and do in emergency is like we often don't have the core expertise, but there's an agency that does. And in an emergency, it's really about bringing folks with the right expertise and skill sets to the table and enabling them to do their work. In this case, you know, last May, it was May 4th, we got a call that we were totally out of space. And, you know, in New York City, there's a lot of confusion about right to shelter versus a sanctuary city. They're two very different things. Sanctuary city doesn't really have anything to do with this population. This population is, you know, whether you agree or not, folks have a legal right to seek asylum. Now, you might say this population is not entitled to asylum. Fine.
That's not your decision to make. Yeah. Nor is it the city's.
It's people are entitled to due process. There is a process that has to work out sometimes because of the backlog in the immigration courts that can take years. And so that has this, the sanctuary status has nothing to do with asylum seekers. We are also a right to shelter city and state, right? In 1981, there was a court case, Kerry versus Callahan. Kerry was the governor of New York at the time. That established a right to shelter in New York. And so we have to provide shelter to anyone who needs it. And that was recently renegotiated with a stipulation that was signed a couple weeks ago. But last May, you know, we can be in violation of a court order if we are not providing shelter to the folks who need it. And so I remember we get on a call with all the agencies. We're throwing out ideas of places that we could possibly move beds into. One of the NYPD chiefs at the time said, John Chell said, you know, what about the old police academy? There's a gym there. We go there. And our agency, one of the things we do is we set up coastal storm shelters where we sort of can, you know, provide shelter to folks for 72, 96 hours during a coastal storm. We did not, you know, that is not the same as housing people for 3-6 months. You need to sort of evolve that model. But we were able to quickly bring cots in there, set up what would be the equivalent of a coastal storm shelter. The mayor was there setting cots up with us in the police academy. He went through there when he went through the police academy. It's funny. I was talking about this with him the other day. We walk, he's like, what about the cafeteria upstairs? It's huge. We could put a lot of people in there. And we walk up to the cafeteria and it was one of those things, like when you walk into your old elementary school and it's much smaller than you remember it. He walks in the cafeteria, he's like, this place used to be so much bigger. What happened? When he was a police recruit, he remembered it being much bigger than it was. But that was the first of what we called our respite centers. We ended up opening up about 18 of them, which are really bare bone facilities with cots where we could provide meals to folks, a place for people to stay that was supposed to be short term. We were running those for about 6-8 months. We now have shut down most of them. Now we're running a reticketing center. And so our role has constantly evolved. But I think one of the things the city's now doing is trying to sort of evolve to say, look, this population is distinct from the homeless population, right? These are folks that are resourceful, resilient, they can work, they want to work. They might have legal barriers to work, but a lot of them can still find jobs. They need a different set of services. And so what does it look like for the city to sort of say, okay, we're going to have an operation that's set up specifically to care for new arrivals and to just get them the basics that they need so that they can get out on their own. And now we've taken in, I think it's close to 190,000 people. Of them, 64,000 are in our care, which means what? That's like 120,000 have taken the next step in their journey, right? They've gotten jobs, they've moved on to other places, they found places to live, which is pretty remarkable over the last 2 years.
Yeah, I feel like that part of the story is not covered, right?
Because it's not covered at all.
Yeah. And I'll be fascinated to see what happens to these folks. And I think about how difficult this job must have been because so many communities just didn't want anybody there. It's like, you know, this has always been true of the homeless population. And I've given some of our elected officials on the upper West and Upper East Side a lot of shit for this because they'll pretend like they're welcoming, but then they'll use every tool in the toolkit to try to prevent anything from opening. And often if you're not an astute observer of it, you don't really see it. And then it allows people to have plausible deniability. And I saw similar tactics back in where I come from, Staten Island, and we're going to do a whole thing on this. But I understand the psychology of Staten Island, and we're going to dive deep into it in an episode we do about this is a place that had Fresh Kills landfill for 50 years, was the dumping ground of New York City. And some of these shelters are in the same neighborhoods like Travis that were where the garbage dump was. So these people are like, the city just constantly just wants to send us whatever. I mean, I don't want to use their language that they don't want to deal with. That's the psychology. Now, the reality of it is pretty hard to look at with, you know, people kind of cheering on migrants getting back on buses without a place to live. And then there's like this sort of big thing hanging over it where some of these facilities were deemed not habitable in ways that are kind of head scratching at times in an emergency, you know, like where people on the ground are like, why are we so aggressive on codes in this situation right now? Where is this coming from? Long question to say, I'm not going to put you in a place to criticize any of these groups that you have to coordinate with who may have been involved in that, but were there neighborhoods that you, it must have been every neighborhood was basically saying no. Were there neighborhoods where you're like, wow, I'm surprised actually welcoming this neighborhood has been?
I can count on with two or three fingers the number of neighborhoods, and it has nothing to do with politics. Like, it really doesn't. Like, left, right, socialist, conservative, MAGA.
Yeah, right. The shelter in Staten Island was in Rosebank, one of them that was closed. There's a neighborhood of immigrants and Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I mean, there are council members who are affiliated with, DSA. DSA. It really doesn't matter. Like, it is, there's been very, very few communities. And there are some, you know, I mean, I would say like the East Village has been amazing. And it's interesting too. Like we put a place out in Whitestone at a shuttered girls' Catholic schools, and Vicky Palladino, who's you know a Republican council member out there, I gotta say, like she was amazing. She really was. Like she called me almost every day or every other day with concerns about the neighborhood. You know, somebody's sleeping on a porch, but she also every day was calling me about concerns about the people in our care. They don't have hot water today, or the meal delivery today was not on par with what it should be. I mean, she really stepped up with her care and concern for the folks in our care, not just with neighborhood concerns. And so it's been interesting. Like, it's not like when it gets down to the local issue, right? Like people, what LaGuardia said, like, there's no Republicans and Democrats when it comes to like caring about your trash getting picked up.
Yeah.
You know, I think in the local, like in this local issue, there's people who, whether on the left side of the aisle or the right side of the aisle, there are people who generally care about people. There's people who generally care about their communities. And I have been sort of surprised at who has been opposed to us, you know, putting a place in their neighborhood. And I have been surprised with people who have been more welcoming and more helpful. And it has not been generally on partisan lines.
What does this say about us as a city? You know, you have the same, actually funny, you have Gotham behind you. So do I. The same book on your bookshelf behind you. You know, you and I love this city a lot. You're a student of history. And I was talking to, I think it was Councilman Borelli about this. I can't remember who it was. Asking like, look, this is if under these expectations, like this is a city that was welcoming in like, you know, orders of magnitude more than this at the turn of the century. And I'm so curious as to how we went from there which there was lots of problems. Like, even, you know, there's even movies about how bad things were, like Gangs of New York, where, you know, the anti-Irish sentiment, for example, was so significant that people were being murdered. So like, it wasn't totally welcoming, but we do have the Statue of Liberty in our harbor. Somehow we've gone from that to this, which is, yes, it's a massive influx, but the city, and I don't mean just the city government, I really mean just the city civically, like the way that the city has handled this makes me wonder where we're at.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think the city has been, first off, I wouldn't romanticize the immigrant experience at like the turn of the last century, right? Like when you look at like tenement housings and the types of jobs that were available, you know, what was like what was happening on the Lower East Side or the Triangle Shirtwaist Fast Fryer. Like, I think we have a tendency to romanticize the past in a way that is probably romantic. But, and I do think the city has been welcoming. I think one of the big differences with this is it's two things. One is immigration laws really changed after World War II, where you started to have real restrictions on immigration in a way you didn't before World War II. And so, you know, when folks were coming over at the turn of the last century, you know, they were coming over, they did their screening at
yeah, there was no restriction. Yeah, basically, unless you had a visible disease, you were allowed into the country.
And we needed, you know, we needed workers. We needed people to settle the interior. You know, New York was an industrial town that needed labor, and the world was coming to New York City, and it was a tough experience for folks. But there were not legal barriers that exist today for folks working, folks resettling. And I think one of the things that happened in the past is when we faced mass migration. And look, this is not the last time the country is going to face mass migration, right? This is, you look at climate change, you look at wars around the world, people are going to continue to come to the United States. But in every mass migration since World War II, I think the difference between this and that is there was the federal government ran real programs to screen folks, to resettle folks, to provide folks with work authorizations, whether it was, you know, after World War II, we had, I think it was like 1.8 million European refugees. They did it with Cubans, with Haitians, with Vietnamese, Soviet Jews. And in each of those cases, it was the federal government that sort of really ran those programs. And now it has largely been left to cities and states to contend with this on their own. And we don't have the legal authorities to navigate a lot of this, right? We can't provide it. We looked at, you know, could we do like a city work permit? You can't.
And remind me, what's the restriction? How long are asylum seekers barred from seeking work?
So it's a little complicated, but it's essentially like once they file their papers, I think it's I would have an immigration attorney come on because there's a lot of nuance to this.
It's like a ridiculous restriction. Like
it is. And it's like there's once you file your paperwork, there's some categories where you can get it within 3 months. You know, some categories where it's in a certain amount of time. There's some countries based on your arrival time where you might have TPS. Authorization, temporary protective status. So Venezuelans that arrived before July of last year can get TPS, which is an expedited way of getting work. If you filled out the CBP One app before crossing the border, there's an expedited pathway to get work authorization. But it really varies, and it is, I mean, I barely understand it, and I've been in it for 2 years. Imagine coming to this country and you don't speak English, how complicated it is to try and understand and navigate the complexities of our immigration system.
Yeah, you make a good point about just like a sane way to handle this. There's a sane way to fix the asylum system, and I think that the legislation that was on the table that the Republicans walked away from, I think would have dramatically improved things. But the federal government abrogating its responsibility, that's a fascinating. Yeah, I mean, because so much of the coverage, and I'm probably guilty of this a bit, is being so hard on the cities. But you're right that like there was a way better. And LaGuardia was an interesting example because there was this period of time when with FDR in the White House and LaGuardia in the mayor, I think it was LaGuardia, Al Smith and FDR, if I think correctly. Mm-hmm. So it was like a trifecta of people who were just working together to improve things for New York, and New York had an outsized role in it was the equivalent of Texas and New York were kind of together. It's like where people were arriving, where they were mostly staying, but also where they were using it as a base to go elsewhere. And the government was helping people get where they needed to go. It'd be interested. Like, number one, the government should fix the asylum system, period. But there'll always be tons of people trying to come in. There should be a way more organized way to get people where they need to be. You could imagine there, you know, with the low unemployment, the way things are, that there are actually a lot of people out there across this country who need workers. And the government could really facilitate the movement of people to where there's work.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the thing. You know, people are not opposed to immigration. People are opposed to the disorder that's occurring. And they want an orderly system. And they want a system that makes sense. I mean, and there's been a bunch of research that's come out in the last couple of weeks showing the economic impact of recent arrivals and immigrants. There's estimated to be another additional 5.2, 5.3 million people immigrated to the U.S. between 2023 and 2033. And the CBC, the Congressional Budget Group that does the analysis, their recent analysis says these new arrivals, 5.3 million, will add $7 trillion to the economy and an additional $1 trillion in government revenues. Right. And there's been some research that came out recently about how a lot of the things that are keeping the economy afloat right now are really due to immigration. I mean, and even anecdotally, like you look at, you know, founders of the two biggest American companies, or two of the biggest, Apple and Google. Steve Jobs was the son of a Syrian refugee. Sergey Brin was a Jewish refugee. You know, not just immigrants, refugees. And I have no doubt, having met some of the people that have been in our care, there are going to be really incredible stories of businesses that have been created, jobs that have been created out of this group that has come through our care.
Well, that's a great place to end, Zach. Thank you so much for everything that you do, man. And hopefully, you know, we're heading for the summer where things get interesting in your world. I can only imagine if you take vacations, you have to stay pretty close.
I do, you know, and you and I got to get out there and surf together at some point.
I know, I'm ready, man, whenever. I always assume you're too busy.
Well, but, the problem with this job is if there's a real swell coming, it probably is coming with weather, and it's not a good look for me to be out in the Rockaways, you know, surfing.
I don't know your surf. For me, those kinds of swells are beyond my pay grade, especially right here. It's actually like, I think we could find a calm day and get out there and do the Rockaways.
I would love it.
All right, my friend.
Good to see you.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. We will be back next week. Remember, our voicemail is 321-200-0570. Have a great weekend, everybody.